It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Do you stay up late using the internet? Are you anxious when you're not connected to the internet? Do you need to use it more and more to feel satisfied?
If you answered yes to any of those questions, experts say you may be addicted to the internet. I don't know. One of the first things I do when I wake up in the morning is check my email. That might be a bad sign.
Well, I guess it depends if you feel anxious, if you are unable, if you can't check your email. Well, how about you? Are you addicted to the internet or do you feel like you might be? Do you have questions about internet addiction? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can send us an email, talk@wpr.org. We also have a discussion about this topic, ironically, on our Facebook page. So if you're addicted and online, you can go there and make a comment.
Well, to help us figure out just what internet addiction is and how we can break the need for the net is Dr. David Greenfield, a licensed psychologist who treats patients for internet addiction and the founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. Dr. Greenfield, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. It's not too hot here today, so that's a nice break.
Where is here again?
Hartford, Connecticut.
Hartford, Connecticut. Nice. Well, let's talk about internet addiction. How new is it? Is it just that we're becoming aware of it now?
Well, you know, it's heating up in terms of the media attention, but I wrote my first book on internet addiction, which was the second book in the world on the subject, and that was in 1999. So we've known that the internet has addictive or what we would call psychoactive properties, meaning that it has components that can change your mood and consciousness, just like a drug or alcohol or gambling. So we've known that it has these addictive properties for quite some time, but like any new problem, it takes years of research and integration into the public for it to become more acceptable. But it was recently listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychiatric Illnesses, and it's gained, a fair amount of acceptance among the medical community and psychiatric community that this is a real issue. What exactly the issue is and what some of the nuances are, I think there's still some disagreement, but there's no question whatsoever that the internet modality has addictive components.
Well, what are the warning signs? How do we know if we're addicted or if one of our kids is getting addicted?
Well, I think the first thing to differentiate is the difference between addicted and abusing or overusing, or because the vast majority of us would probably be guilty of abusing or overusing the internet. In other words, we're probably spending more time than we need to. And the reason why that is the interesting phenomenon called dissociation. One of the things I did in my research originally back in the 90s was we looked at what happens when people go online, regardless of the modality, whether it's on a desktop or an iPad or a smartphone or any other digital media devices. People lose track of time and space. I'm sure you have experienced it yourself, mm-hmm. that you get on, you say you're going to check your email, and then an hour later, you're still on futzing around doing something else. When something creates that dissociative experience, it means that it can change your mood and consciousness, so it is therefore likely to be abusable. In order to meet the criteria for addiction, you know, where it really has impacted your life, you have to have some very negative criteria that have occurred in your life. You have to have some impact in your primary relationships, your work life, school performance, legal status, financial health, and you have to be experiencing discomfort when you are not online or when your online access is taken away. There has to be some urges and cravings with regard to the use and access to the internet, and there are a number of other features. And that group is probably, you know, there have been estimates all over the place from 1 or 2% all the way up to 38% I saw the other day. I think that's a very high number. My research came up with about 6% that would meet the criteria for addiction, but that doesn't mean there isn't a whole lot of us that are abusing it or overusing it in perhaps an unhealthy way.
You know, what's so hard about it is it's so many of the sites that people like to go to, you know, look at Facebook, you look at Pinterest, you can scroll infinitely. You can scroll forever. And then before you know it, you've been sitting down for 3 hours when you intended to sit down for 5 minutes.
Right. That's what makes it so powerful. Now, there's another interesting thing that makes it very powerful, which is, and what I say is that the Internet is the world's largest slot machine. And let me explain that to you because it's kind of an interesting concept. Every time you go online, regardless of what you go online for, whether it's to check your email, whether it's a text, whether it's to surf for something, whether it's to look for specific information, check stock scores, it doesn't really matter, stock rates, whatever it is, you don't really know what you're going to find. You can't predict what the information is going to be. You don't know when you're going to get that good email from Wisconsin Public Radio saying, we'd like you to be on the show. Mixed in with all the Viagra ads. So it's a hit or miss phenomenon. And that's one of the reasons why people keep checking and rechecking and overchecking their internet access. Why people will check their text, their email, their Twitter over and over, or even check the news on the internet, because it's dynamic and changing. And because it's unpredictable in terms of how pleasurable it's going to be, meaning how much you're going to like what you're going to see, and then how and when it's going to occur, that's exactly the same reinforcement principle that a slot machine operates on. So in essence, the Internet inadvertently has become the world's largest slot machine.
That is such a good way of thinking about it. You know, it is. It's like you're the rat waiting for the pellet when you hit the lever at the right time.
Right. And plus, when you add, like now, of course, now 50% of Internet access now is coming on smartphones. So everybody, I think we're at 60% now penetration for smartphones in the United States. So now smartphones are becoming the preferred access for Internet access because we have them with us. But now we've got little beeps and buzzes and lights and things which let us know that we've got a little pellet waiting to eat like a rat in a maze. So what we've done is we've combined operant conditioning, like Pavlov's dogs, with the idea of classical conditioning with these buzzes and beeps that let us know. So you watch people, you'll see when something buzzes or beeps, they have this automatic reaction. And what we don't realize is that triggers neurochemical changes with elevations in dopamine. And then when you open the email or the text or whatever it is, and it's something really good, that elevation in dopamine goes up even further, and that reinforces the process even further.
So you make a really convincing case for how serious it can be. You're talking chemical changes in the brain.
Absolutely.
So how do we begin to break that habit when we're starting to get looped into it?
Well, I mean, the truth is that the treatment or the way to address any addiction or overuse problem is consciousness, is awareness of how, when, and where you do what you do. So we really recommend that people start keeping track, whether it's in writing. There's plenty of software, programs, and applications that you can download that will let you know how long you're on and what you're doing when you're on. So first rule of thumb is consciousness. The second rule is to start to set limits on when you use it. In other words, don't take your smartphone into dinner with you when you go into the restaurant. Leave it in the car. If you're going on a family picnic, don't take the cell phone with you. If you're going into the bathroom, I know that sounds ridiculous, but don't take it with you. Have times of your life where you are consciously offline, and you communicate that to the people in your life, whether that be your employers, friends or family members. It's an illusion that people believe that you have to be accessible all the time, 24/7.
Well, we're talking to Dr. David Greenfield about internet addiction now, and we'd love to hear from you. Are you worried that you might be addicted to the internet, or maybe someone you know, maybe one of your children? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you found strategies for working around this, for unraveling yourself a little bit from the internet, you can share that as well.
We'll continue our discussion with Dr. Greenfield coming up in just a few minutes. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion on internet addiction with Dr. David Greenfield, founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. We're taking your calls now. Your experience, do you find yourself having trouble decoupling from your iPhone, wanting to take it with you everywhere, check it all the time, check your text, check your email? Does it worry you at all, or do you think it's just part of the modern way of living? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. And going back to how we can start to decouple ourselves from the internet, you know, some people have put forth that we should have maybe an internet sabbatical, just say the weekend. I will not be online from Friday night to Monday morning. What do you think of kind of cold turkey approaches like that?
I think that's a great idea. I mean, I think part of the reason why people have been reluctant to do this is that there's been kind of this positive valence around technology, which started in the corporate sector, because the corporate sector was the first part of the U.S. culture to kind of buy into the portable internet access, mainly the smartphone. And then it worked its way into the mainstream culture, and now, you know, every high school kid has an iPhone. But it was built on the premise that having increased access and accessibility and having all that technology at your fingertips would actually increase productivity. But guess what? That's not really what's happened. In fact, productivity has dropped as a result of technology, because the technology eats so much time, both in terms of distractible, non-work-related activities, as well as dealing with problems with the technology, that all that we thought it would provide has not really materialized. So one of the things is to set aside time on the weekend where you're offline. It's interesting, there are more companies now starting to actually formalize these ideas that they will get better employees and better productivity if they have specified time where their people are offline, where they're not in that hypervigilant, cortisol-aroused state where they are always on, and that they get better employees that when they have that natural downtime, so when they are at work, they're really at peak performance.
Well, let's take a phone call now. We go to Mark, who is joining us from Toma. Hi, Mark.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm calling regarding, my wife is constantly on the computer. If she's not sleeping or eating or doing some other things, she's on the computer. And I'll be 50 this year, and I think back to when I was younger, and cell phones were like almost non-existent, and we did real good. And I think it's like carrying a pocket full of problems with me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Almost, instead of coming home and dealing with it at one time, now your day can get screwed up by 9:30 because you got a cell phone. I think it's especially younger kids anymore. Everything's on them darn phones. So.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, thank you, Mark, for sharing, your experience with it. A pocket full of problems. It can seem like that, can it?
It's a good way to put it.
And yet, it is part of the way we live right now. So,
one of the things that I want to emphasize is that, I'm not suggesting that we all become Luddites and we go back to, the times when we didn't have cell phones or any of this digital media technology. First of all, that's unlikely. Really, what I'm promoting is to have some consciousness about how and when we use it, and to develop an electronic etiquette for times that we don't use it, for going into a restaurant and checking your cell phone at the door, so you don't have a place setting with knives, forks, and then two cell phones sitting on the table, to really sort of set some limits and boundaries around the use and potential abuse of the technology. That's really all we're advocating.
Now, I want to talk a little bit about children, because we were talking about changes in the brain, and there's a lot of research out now about how susceptible, for instance, the brains of teenagers are and how they are especially vulnerable, I guess, during these teen years. Is internet addiction even more a danger when we're looking at that age? Do we need to be even more conscious about how our teenagers are using technology?
Yeah, there are a lot of preliminary studies coming out about, and both, by the way, those studies are both kind of pro and con. But some of the studies are talking about the fact that kids are not using their frontal lobes very actively because they have learned to develop the use of Google as an alternate means of thinking about something. So the critical reasoning, thinking, memory skills, concept formation skills that are necessary for understanding knowledge and then incorporating that knowledge and then remembering and recalling and expressing that knowledge have been really transferred to Google. So there's some concern that, you know, the old rule in neurology is if you don't use it, you lose it. So the fear is that if you don't use those neurological skills, that they will weaken and they will somehow atrophy and you will have less ability to use them. And there's some evidence to suggest that that's true. You know, this generation, which I call Generation D, this is the 25 and under group, this is the first generation that was born and bred on digital technology, that they have never been alive without it. So we're just starting to look at this group of people, and there is some startling evidence to suggest that they may be a little bit different in the way they process information. Their work ethic may be different. One thing for sure is that they have a greater sense of the need for instant gratification because the internet really proposes the idea that you can get anything instantly, whether it's information or ordering something or looking at a pornographic image, for instance.
So how do you manage it in your life? Obviously, you are hyper-conscious about how you're using technology. You're not a Luddite, but I mean...
No, I'm not a Luddite.
Are you the guy who, you know, says, I'm going on vacation, see ya, I'm not going to have my cell phone?
Well, you know, I'm going to be honest with you. I struggle with it just like everybody else. I have recently started leaving my cell phone in the car when I go into restaurants and when I go on social activities. And when I go into a movie or when I am doing something that is, you know, fun and not work-related. And I have to tell you, I have found it to be liberating. There's something really powerful about sort of not having that phone with you and not having that accessibility. So I will do that. I will try to limit the amount of time I spend online doing non-work related activities, but I too, you know, I occasionally have had my bouts of Amazon.com or eBay addiction, where I now go crazy for a while buying things and on one of those two websites, and it's very easy to do that. The other thing that I have done is I have tried to beef up other things that are real time and not reliant on technology, which is a big thing that we teach our patients. Is how to beef up other skills in their lives that have kind of atrophied or have become, they've become out of practice.
Like what?
Like taking a walk. Like climbing a tree. Like going for a boat ride. You know, talking to a friend. Going out for a cup of coffee. Again, you know, sans cell phone. Doing things, you know, drawing a painting, reading a book. Not an electronic book. You know, trying to sort of, we actually work with people to develop what we call the real-time 100, which is 100 things they can do without technology. Because the technology is in your face all the time, and now it's in your pocket, you don't really have to think too hard about what needs to be done or what could be done that's not digitally related.
Right.
So we have to retrain our brains to think that way.
And it sounds like there's rewards that go along with that, too. It's not just denial and, you know, holding back.
Oh, no, not quite the contrary. Not only that, productivity goes up. I mean, in terms of kids with school, you know, we just did a DVD called Raising Generation D. It's on Amazon.com now. And it teaches parents on that their kids' productivity can actually go up if they limit and monitor their technology use.
And we will link to that website, www.virtualaddiction.com. Lots of information there. Dr. Greenfield, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Is there... Yes.
It was a pleasure talking with you. And that was Dr. David Greenfield, a licensed psychologist who treats patients for internet addiction, and he's the founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction.
He's the author of Virtual Addiction and Raising Generation D. Well, I'm going to be more careful, spend some offline time tonight, maybe just read a book.
Well, good luck.
I think it'll be
a good for both of us to do tonight. Coming up next on Central Time, we'll talk about bike safety in Milwaukee and in all of Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we'll talk about NSA leaker Edward Snowden and his effort to get asylum in another country.
But first, it's biking season in Wisconsin. With decent weather out there, a lot of people are hitting the streets and the trails. But sometimes bikes, cars, and pedestrians have a hard time getting along. Joining us to discuss some important safety tips is Dave Schlabowski with the Bike Federation of Wisconsin. He joins us today from Milwaukee. Dave, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me on the show.
Now, I understand the number of bicycle traffic fatalities is pretty small compared to vehicles, but I gather bike deaths are already higher than what happened last year. What's going on there?
Well, you know, the numbers are so small that it's really difficult to draw, you know, year-to-year conclusions about safety and things like that. Obviously, a single death is one too many, and we certainly don't want that to happen, and there are ways that people can ride more safely. But I'd just like to say, I mean, if you, like I said, if you look at the fatal crashes over the last 10 years, they always fluctuate between 12 and 8 or something like that. But the overall crash rate has been for bicycles versus cars has been on a consistent decline for like the last 15 years or so in Wisconsin. Bicycling keeps getting safer. It is a really safe thing to do in general. There are some things, though, that we can all do to make it safer for everybody.
Well, let's jump in on that point. I know you look at bike accidents, car, bike, pedestrian. What are some common themes? Like if we all just did blank, we could cut those numbers even further?
Well, the first and probably most important and perhaps obvious is that if everybody fares best when we all, no matter what vehicle we're in, we're walking or we're riding a bike or we're driving a car, when we all obey the rules of the road. So that means, you know, if you're in a car, it means, you know, driving a speed limit and yielding to pedestrians at crosswalks and passing bicycles with 3 feet. If you're on a bike, it means going the same direction as traffic is supposed to go in the lane. You don't ever ride against traffic. Riding is reasonably close to the right side of the road. Stopping at red lights, things like that. You know, if you're a pedestrian, you should cross at a corner if at all possible, you know, and if not, you don't have a right to jump out of the road. Cars don't have to look out for you in the middle of the street. You have to look out for them. They have to look out for you if you're in a crosswalk. But so that's the first thing. You know, we should all do a better job of you know, paying attention to the task at hand, no matter what vehicle we're in.
Now, I see a lot of times when these issues come up in the news, if you read a comment section or do a call-in show, say, there's a lot of blame game going on. The drivers are mad at the bicyclists and vice versa, and the pedestrians are bugged by them both. It sounds like you're taking a more of a we're all in this together kind of approach.
Well, in my previous job, I worked for the City of Milwaukee Department of Public Works, and as part of that, I was in charge of a program we called the Neighborhood Traffic Management, where I fielded complaints about speeding on residential streets, about cars not letting people cross, about bicycles, you know, not stopping at red. I was the complaint department.
Uh-huh. So. That must have been fun.
Yeah, right. It's a great job. But actually, I learned, I work in the Department of Public Works, and I work very closely with the traffic engineering section, and I learned to look at facts and figures and do studies before we did knee-jerk reactions to any sort of complaint about a traffic safety issue. So the first thing we'd do is we'd do studies. You know, somebody says everybody's speeding on my block. Well, we put out a speed detector and we check how many cars are really speeding. Sometimes they were right, you know, lots of people were, and other times it was maybe, you know, not as bad of a problem as they reported. We would get complaints about bicycles going through red lights at intersections. So we'd send out an intern, they'd sit there with a traffic counter and they'd click how many people were riding on the sidewalk when they shouldn't, how many ran red lights and all that sort of stuff. We did counts at crosswalks where pedestrians said, I can't get across the street, no cars will yield to me. You know, so we would count the cars and count, you know, how many times they yielded to pedestrians. And in my experience has been that no matter what mode of transportation people take, a certain percentage of people are going to break the laws that they know they can get away with breaking safely if it gets them from point A to point B faster. So if you're in a car, you're going to drive over the speed limit a little bit. If you're on a bike and nobody's at a red light, you might run that red light. If you're a pedestrian and you're walking and it says don't walk but there aren't any cars, you might cross anyway. So I understand the acrimony between the different groups, but we all wear these same hats. I drive a car, I ride a bike, and I walk. So, you know, I guess it all depends on what perspective what hat you're wearing at the time you want to complain.
When you look at communities around the state, are there a couple things that are proven, I guess, interventions from local, county, even state governments when they imposed this, when they made this change, it really seemed to help things out?
Well, sure. There are a number of things. I mean, with any traffic safety thing, there's several E's. You know, there's education, there's engineering, there's encouragement, and there's enforcement. So you want to make sure people are educated. You know, at the Wisconsin Bike Fed, we teach thousands of kids in our Safe Routes to School every year. We teach adults. We have a Share and Beware program where we go out to things like county fairs and we provide safety information about all forms of transportation, walking and biking, share the rules of the road. So that education component is important. We work with driver's ed instructors to get, you know, the safety information to them, too. So education in communities that do more education tend to have, you know, better, you know, compliance with the rules of the road. We don't have any mandatory classes to teach people the rules of the road that apply to bicycling, so some people don't know them. The general rule is that most rules that apply to cars apply to bikes. There's a few exceptions, but that's the general rule. So, but a lot of people don't know that. They think they should ride the opposite way. That's not the case. You should never do that. It's illegal and it's far more dangerous. So education counts. Enforcement, communities that have more enforcement, that helps. About speeding, you can go to the Dells. It's really easy to walk across the street as busy as it is in traffic-wise in the Dells. It's really cars yield to you because the Dells has had a big campaign. You know, tourists are important. Lots of them walk around, so they've had a big campaign to get that word out, enforce it, encourage people to yield to pedestrians in their crosswalks. So those sorts of things help. Communities that build bicycle facilities tend to have more people riding, and when you have more people riding, you have fewer crashes. So, the communities like Madison have percentage-wise much lower crash rates than communities that don't have as many bike lanes or trails, things like that.
And just to wrap up, how are we doing? You mentioned bike lanes in cities. How are we doing on bike lanes and trails along rural highways, county highways?
You know, that's getting much better. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation is doing a real good job of adding, you know, wider shoulders when they're reconstructing roads. It may not be marked as a bike facility, but it has multiple benefits. So a slightly wider shoulder reduces, you know, crashes for all vehicles, motor vehicles as well as bicycles, but it also provides people walking in those rural communities where maybe a sidewalk or an actual bike path isn't necessary. A 4-foot shoulder, you know, provides that little space where people feel safer, and it reduces conflicts. So the DOT has been doing that kind of as a matter of course on many of their projects. Many local smaller communities are starting to see the value of this as well. You know, I've been vacationing up in Vilas County since I was a little kid, and it's still the musky capital of the world, don't get me wrong, but I tell you what, when you are on Main Street down in Boulder Junction, there are just as many bikes and bike racks on those cars as there are trailer hitches with boats. And why is that? Because Vilas County's built this wonderful trail system up there that everybody likes to ride. So you're going to go up to Vilas County, you're still going to go fishing, and you're going to enjoy all the Northwoods things, you know, fish fries and supper clubs that everybody goes to the Northwoods to enjoy. But people also go there to ride bikes and to go to coffee shops and stuff like that. So our rural communities are starting to see the value of adding these facilities, and many of them are doing it with some of their own money as well as with a combination of federal money.
Dave, that's a great place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you.
That was Dave Schlabowski, Interim Director of the Bike Federation of Wisconsin. Coming up next, Edward Snowden, the man who released government surveillance secrets, is on the run. He's seeking asylum in another country. We'll talk about what he's facing and the politics involved. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Edward Snowden's search for asylum continues. The 30-year-old whistleblower spoke up today from his location at a Moscow airport, saying he's free to publish more about surveillance programs in the U.S. and that he's being illegally persecuted.
But more and more countries have turned down his request for asylum, and Russia says he can't stay unless he stops publishing those secrets. So what's next for Snowden, and what exactly does it mean to get political asylum?
Joining us now is Olga Hazan, global editor at The Atlantic. Olga, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about Edward Snowden's attempts to seek out a country that'll take him in, but what exactly does it mean to have political asylum?
Sure. Well, that means being kind of a refugee type person, and it means that you're fleeing from persecution, that you feel like you might be persecuted for your political beliefs rather than for some crime that you've committed. So he's trying to make the argument that these leaks were sort of a part of political advocacy on his part, and that if he were sent back, that the kind of charges against him and the trial would be kind of unfair, or that it wouldn't match the severity of his crime.
Now, so far he's been turned down by a slew of countries, and we're not sure where he's going to end up. What makes his case difficult at this point?
Well, what makes it difficult is that, there's a lot of factors, obviously, but one thing is that the U.S. is sort of seems to be kind of putting some pressure on certain countries to kind of keep them from taking him in. So, for example, Vice President Biden spoke with Ecuador's president to sort of remind him about some preferential trade agreements so that they would be less likely to grant him asylum. It's also going to be tough for him to make the claim that he's part of like a protected group or some sort of class that, you know, is unfairly persecuted in the United States, as opposed to just someone who has committed a crime. There's a lot of sort of political issues at play here, so it's not really a straightforward legal case. And then there's the fact that he's sort of trapped in the airport, and it's going to be tough for him to get to a country, one of these countries that say that, you know, he would have to actually be on their territory in order to file an asylum application.
Now, it's interesting because it seems to me that the U.S. has been kind of playing it cool on this one. We haven't acted overly eager to get him back. President Obama has been saying it's not his top priority. And yet, Snowden seems to be getting blocked at a lot of turns. So what do you think is happening backstage?
You know, I'm not entirely sure, but I think a part of the reason is that nobody wants to seem desperate here to get him, right? I mean, Obama has said that he doesn't want to go, you know, send jets, you know, going to get a 29-year-old hacker. I think part of it is just posturing. Like, Putin is also acting very nonchalant about the whole thing, saying, you know, he's welcome to stay. He just has to stop the leaks. So I think eventually just someone is going to give in, or, you know, he's going to find himself that he's out of options and that he's been in the airport for too long and going to be sent home.
Do you have a sense of what the status of Snowden's relationship with Russia is at this point, since that's where he is?
Of Snowden's? Well, yeah, I have no idea, because it seems like at first he almost wanted to stay there, that he had submitted an asylum application. But he recently he withdrew his request because it seems like he wants to continue with these activities with whistleblowing and with exposing various government injustices. Or what he perceives as injustices. It seems like that relationship has sort of, you know, soured. And it seems to go that way on behalf of the Russian government as well. And then there's the fact that Russia might want to, you know, interrogate him in some way or to get some information from him. So they might also be interested in keeping him there a while longer just to see what he knows.
And yet he's got some support in Russia. It sounds like he's got some of Russia's political players and intelligentsia saying, you know, what's the big deal? You know, the U.S. doesn't have that great a relationship with Russia anyway. Why don't we just let him stay?
Right, exactly. And for a lot of Russians, this kind of shows, I mean, this sort of plays into the idea that, you know, whenever Russia is criticized in the American media, there's always sort of this, what about the U.S. and what about, you know, bad things that America has done. So this is sort of one example of that, where it's like, oh, well, look, you know, he's shining a light on all of these misdeeds. So, you know, we should grant him political asylum just to show our support for, you know, kind of casting our you know, Americans in a bad light. And, you know, but I think there was someone quoted in the Daily Beast, actually, the chairperson of the Civil Support Committee there, who said that she only can think of one person who's been granted political asylum in Russia, and that's the former Azerbaijani president. So it seems like even though there might be a lot of support for this, there's maybe not a whole lot of precedent for granting this kind of asylum for people like Snowden.
Well, it sounds like at this point, Venezuela is the leading contender to take Snowden in. Now, this is a country with a brand new leader after lots of years under Hugo Chavez, and the relationship between Venezuela and the U.S. is a little strained. So how big of a political statement would it be if Venezuela did take Snowden in?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we can't really know whether or not this is just sort of posturing or not until he actually is able to get there and you know, they either accept or reject his asylum claim. But, I mean, so Venezuela has sort of a history of tension with the U.S., but it, you know, Maduro has been sort of reiterating his offer of asylum, and, you know, but I feel like there's not a lot of support from the Venezuelan people for taking in Snowden, and so we can't actually know how that will pan out until he actually submits his application there.
Do you ever think about what his life must be like right now, holed up in a Moscow airport? He's on the run. He doesn't know where he's going. He must be under tremendous stress. What do you think is going through his mind?
You know, I think that's a really interesting part of this. There actually have been cases of other people having to live in airports for a while when they were seeking asylum. Of course, the joke that everyone kind of made when this whole thing happened was the parallels to the movie The Terminal with Tom Hanks. That was an Iranian, based on the story of an Iranian man who lived in the Paris airport for a really long time. But, you know, there have been other cases, including, you know, Chinese dissidents who have spent time in various airports and people who have been turned away by countries where they were seeking asylum. I imagine it must be incredibly stressful and incredibly mentally taxing. And, you know, he also recently, he wrote that statement, you know, that was posted on the WikiLeaks website yesterday. And, you know, some people speculated that it didn't seem like maybe he had written it because there were some elements of it that didn't sound like maybe an American would have written it. So we don't know if maybe he's sort of like allowing WikiLeaks to kind of advocate on his behalf in some ways, or whether he's still totally in control of his own situation.
And he was hoping to get to Ecuador, right, where Julian Assange, WikiLeaks' founder, is right now, and I guess that didn't pan out.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, Assange has been in Ecuador's London embassy, and I think it was Assange who initially pressured Ecuador's president, Rafael Correa, to accept Snowden. And it did seem like for a while they were going to. But I think just today or yesterday they came out and said that the assistance that they had sort of offered him, they had given him some temporary travel documents because the U.S. had taken away his passport. And so they described doing this as a mistake. And they said that he couldn't travel to Ecuador without his passport. And, you know, I think that phone call from Biden really did make a difference. So this is maybe kind of showing that although countries might in theory support this idea of whistleblowing or exposing, surveillance and things like that, ultimately they don't want to kind of tweak the U.S. too much or ruin relations too much, especially on behalf of someone who represents kind of this rogue kind of trend of leakers coming from inside agencies and exposing government misdeeds. Maybe they don't necessarily want to side with WikiLeaks over the U.S.
And we've got just about a minute left here, but what do you think will happen if nobody steps up to take Edward Snowden in? What happens then?
I mean, I really have no idea. So your guess is as good as mine, but I think, he could try to stay in Russia. Russia doesn't have an extradition treaty with the U.S., so he could stay there and Russia could just refuse to extradite him. He could end up in a place like Iceland that's, been kind of friendly to leakers in general and to WikiLeaks in particular. And he could end up in a place like Venezuela. I mean, there have been past cases of Americans who have sought asylum in various countries, and they grant them this kind of political asylum, or they don't extradite them because of various kind of exemptions and sort of specific elements of their extradition treaties that they point to, saying, we can't send them back because we espionage is not in our extradition treaty. So that's how Bobby Fischer ended up, dying in Iceland and not in the U.S.
Well, it's one that we'll all be watching closely. Olga, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
That was Olga Khazan, global editor at The Atlantic.
Coming up tomorrow afternoon on Central Time, we'll get ready for the 4th of July with a look at fireworks laws in Wisconsin and how different the laws and the enforcement are in different parts of the state.
That's coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.